It meant I had to move even faster, if I could. I hurried back to the bureau and found Van Allsburg in his office. "Don't ask me, not my call," he said, after I'd made my case for the interview. "If Maddox Fielding wants to move in on her, then do me one favor," I said. Minutes later, we were on the phone in Fred's office. I knew Maddox Fielding probably wouldn't take my call, but Van Allsburg got patched through right away. "Maddox, I've got Alex Cross here. He's making a pretty good argument for holding off on Mary Wagner, just long enough to interview her." "How much more do you think we're going to get on her?" Fielding asked. "It's done. We've got plenty to take her in." "It's all circumstantial," I said into the speakerphone. "You'll have to let her go." "Yeah, well, I'm working on that." "What do you mean?" I asked, already starting to fume. "What aren't you telling us, Maddox? What's the point of shutting us out?" He ignored my legitimate question with one of his trademark stony silences. "Listen, between LAPD and the Bureau, she's under constant surveillance. She hasn't shown any sign of making a move. We know her timetable. Let me just talk to her at home. This could be a last chance to get her in a non-defensive state." I hated the conciliatory tone of my voice, but I knew the interview with Mary could be important. "Detective, I know you and I have our disagreements," I said, "but we're both going for a quick resolve here. This is what I do best. If you'll just let me..." "Be at her house by 6, he said suddenly. "I'm not making any promises to you, though, Cross. If she doesn't go home after work, or if anything else changes, that's the end of it. We grab her." By the time I had arched my eyebrows, there was a click on the line, and the call was over. Chapter 91. She didn't bother to use the chain lock. I heard it rattle on the back of the front door as she opened it. "Mary Wagner?"
"Yes."
Her large feet were bare, but she still wore the pink maid's uniform from the Beverly Hills Hotel. She smiled engagingly before she knew who I was. "I'm Agent Cross with the FBI. I held up my ID, which included my shield. "May I come in and ask you a few questions? It's important." Her tired face sagged.
"It's about the car, isn't it? Lord, I wish I could just paint that thing or trade it in or something. I've been getting all kinds of embarrassing looks you wouldn't believe."
Her manner was more outgoing than anything I'd seen at the hotel, but she had the beleaguered, animated quality of a public school kindergarten teacher with way too many students. "Yes, ma'am," I said. "It is about the car. Just a formality. We're following up on as many blue Suburbans as we can. May I come in? It won't take long."
"Of course. I didn't mean to be rude. Please, come on inside. Come."
I waved to Baker on the curb. 5 minutes, I called out, mostly just to let Ms. Wagner know I wasn't alone at her house. Hopefully, the unmarked LAPD units up and down the street were more invisible to her eyes than mine. I stepped inside and she closed the door behind me. Adrenaline shot through my body in an instant. Was this woman a killer, possibly an insane one? For some strange reason, I didn't feel threatened by her. The neatness of the house made a strong first impression on me. The floors were recently swept, and I saw no signs of clutter anywhere. A wooden cutout hung in the front hallway. It was in the shape of a curtsying farm girl with the word "Welcome" stenciled across her skirt. The relative disrepair outside, I suddenly realized, was the landlord's domain. This was hers.
"Please sit down."
Mary Wagner gestured me toward the living room through an archway to my right. A mismatched sofa and love seat took up most of the room. Her television was on mute, and a can of Diet Pepsi and a half-eaten bowl of soup sat on the worn redwood coffee table. "Am I interrupting your dinner?" I asked. "I'm real sorry about that." Not that I was going to leave.
"Oh, no, not at all. I'm not much of an eater.
She quickly turned off the TV and cleared the food away. I stayed in the hall and glanced around while she put the dishes on the kitchen counter in the back. Nothing looked out of place. Just a regular house that was almost too neat, uncluttered, spick and span clean.
Would you like something to drink?
She called out from the other room. Nothing, thanks.
Water, soda, orange juice, it's no bother, Agent Cross.
I'm fine. Her journal was probably here in the house, but nowhere that I could see. She'd been watching Jeopardy on TV.
Actually, I'm out of orange juice anyway.
She said genially, coming back toward me. She was either completely comfortable or very good at faking it. Very odd. I followed her into the living room and we both sat down.
So, what can I do for you?
She asked in a kindly tone that was oddly unsettling.
I'd like to help, of course.
I kept my own tone casual and non-threatening. First of all, are you the only driver for your car?
Just me.
She smiled as though the question was vaguely funny. I wondered why. Has it been outside your supervision at any time in the past 6 weeks or so?
Well, when I sleep, of course. And when I'm at work, I do housekeeping at the Beverly Hills Hotel.
I see. So you need the car for transportation to work. She fingered the collar of her uniform and eyeballed the pad in my hand as though she wanted me to write that part down. On an impulse, I went ahead and did it.
So I guess the answer is yes. Technically, it has been outside of my, whatever you said, supervision.
Her laugh was a tiny bit coy.
My purview.
I scribbled a few more notes of my own. Eager to please. Busy hands. Wants me to know she's intelligent. As we continued, I watched her as much as I listened. Nothing she said was really out of the ordinary, though. What struck hardest was the way she concentrated on me. Her hands kept landing in different places, but her brown eyes didn't travel very far from my own. I got the impression she was glad I was there. When I stood up at the end of the interview, as if to leave, her face dropped. "Could I bother you for that glass of water?" I asked. And she brightened visibly.
Coming right up.
I followed her as far as the doorway. Everything in the kitchen was neatly arranged, too. The counters were mostly empty, except for a 4-slice toaster and a set of country kitsch-style canisters. The dish rack next to the sink was full, and there were 2 steak knives among the clean silverware. She filled a glass at the tap and handed it to me. It tasted slightly soapy. "Are you originally from California?" I asked, conversationally. "From around here?"
"Oh, no. Nowhere near as nice as this,"
she said. "Where'd you move from?"
"The North Pole."
Another coy laugh and a shake of the head.
"At least it might as well be."
"Let me guess. Maine? You strike me as a New Englander."
"Can I get you a refill?"
"No, thank you. Really, I'm fine." She took the water glass out of my hand, not yet half empty, and turned toward the sink. That was when all hell broke loose. First, I heard heavy footsteps and a loud shout coming from just outside. Almost immediately, the back door burst open with a crash of splintering wood and glass. I heard the front door crashing in as well. Then police officers streamed into the kitchen from both sides, black jackets on, their weapons drawn and pointed at Mary Wagner. Chapter 92. Mary dropped the water glass, but I didn't even hear it break. Suddenly the kitchen was filled with loud shouting, as well as Mary's frightened screaming.
"Get out of my house! I didn't do anything! Get away from me, please! Why are you here?"
I held up my badge in front of me, unsure if the LAPD assault team even knew who I was. "Get down on the floor!" The lead officer's pistol was pointed at Mary's chest. "Get down! Now! On the floor!" In a matter of seconds, Mary Wagner was a total wreck. Her eyes were unfocused, and she didn't even seem to hear the officer shouting at her. "Get down!" he shouted again. She backed up, still screaming, with her arms and shoulders in a hunched, defensive position. I could only watch as her bare foot came down on a piece of the broken water glass. She yelped pitifully, then jerked to one side as if she'd been slapped. Her free foot slipped in the water and twisted under her. With a fast pinwheeling of arms, she went down hard. The police assault team was on her in a second. Two officers rolled Mary over and handcuffed her from behind. Another one read her rights, the words probably coming too fast for her to understand. Someone took my elbow and spoke in my ear. "Sir, could you come with me, please?" I ignored whoever it was. "Sir!" The officer grabbed at me again, and I angrily shook him off. "She needs first aid." But no one seemed to hear me, or if they did, pay any attention. "Ma'am, do you understand everything I've told you?" the arresting officer asked. She nodded shakily, still face down on the floor. I was fairly certain she didn't understand any of this. "Ma'am, I need you to say yes or no. Do you understand everything I've told you?"
"Yes!"
It came out as a gasp. Her breathing was ragged.
"I understand. You think I did something bad."
That was enough. I pushed my way through the cops and knelt down next to her. "Mary, it's me. Agent Cross. Are you all right? Mary, do you really understand what's happening now?" She was still panicked, but not dissociated. I made sure the shard was out of her foot, then wrapped it in a dish towel and helped her sit up. She looked around, wide-eyed, as if scanning the room for anything familiar. "Mary, they're placing you under arrest. You need to go with them now. Do you understand what I'm saying?" "All right, we got it." A cop maybe half my age stepped in. "Just give me a second here," I said. "No, sir," he answered. "We're to take the suspect into immediate custody." I turned away from Mary and kept my voice low. "What do you think I'm trying to help you do here?" "Sir, my instructions are clear and unequivocal. Please step away. This is our arrest." My only alternative to giving in was a truly ugly scene. I thought seriously about it, but knew my argument wasn't with the arresting officers. It was with their boss. Anyway, the damage was already done. Within seconds, they had Mary Wagner on her feet and were pushing her out the door. The stained dish towel lay crumpled on the floor, where a long red smudge marked the linoleum. "First aid!" I yelled after them. Not that they could hear me anymore. Not that they gave a damn about what I had to say. I swear I wanted to hit someone. My frustration and anger boiled over, and I knew where to take it. I wheeled on the nearest sergeant. "Where the hell is Maddox Fielding?" I shouted at the top of my voice. "Where is he?" Chapter 93. "Back off, Cross." Fielding said it before I even reached him. He was out on the sidewalk in front of Mary Wagner's house, conferring with one of his arresting officers. The block had been transformed from suburban normalcy into the kind of police scene most people never see or want to. A dozen or more black and whites clogged the street, most of them with their flashers still rolling. Bright yellow crime scene tape was being strung across the chain-link fence, and a barrier of sawhorses bracketed the property, holding back a fast-growing crowd of looky-loos who wanted to see a little true crime history in the making. "Mary Smith lived right in that house. Can you imagine? In our neighborhood?" I saw that a couple of news vans were already on site as well. I wondered if Maddox Fielding had prearranged a little coverage for his big get, and it made me even angrier. "What was the purpose of that?" I yelled at him. All I could see was his smug expression as he grudgingly turned to look at me. You compromised a key interview, not to mention her personal safety and mine. Both unnecessarily. I could have been shot. She could have been shot. You made a carnival out of this arrest. You're a disgrace to the LAPD. I didn't know or care who was listening in. I just hoped it was embarrassing to Fielding. Maybe this was a language that he spoke. His face remained inscrutable. Agent Cross, do you know what you may have just done to your chances for a confession?
I don't need one,
he finally shouted over me.
I don't need one because I have something better.
What are you talking about? He nodded condescendingly. Information was the valuable currency here, and he had it. What the hell was he holding back?
You can probably see I'm busy, he told me. I'll make my report available to the Federal Bureau as soon as it's ready.
I couldn't walk away.
You gave me time for this interview. I had your word.
He had already turned away, but now pivoted back on me.
I said if anything changed, it was over. That's precisely what I said to you.
So what changed, goddammit? He took a beat.
Fuck you, Agent Cross. I don't have to give you answers.
I lunged at him, and it was probably exactly what he wanted. Two of his monkeys stepped between us and pulled me back. Just as well. But it would have felt good to erase that cynical sneer off his face. Even better to briefly rearrange some of his features. I shook off the two officers and walked away. Before I'd even begun to calm down, though, I was dialing my cell phone.
Gene Galletta.
It's Alex Cross. Do you know anything about the Mary Wagner arrest?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
Sorry.
But do you, Gene? I'm at her house right now. It's an incredible mess. You wouldn't believe how it went down.
Gene paused.
I'm not on that case anymore.
Would I get a different answer in person?
You might.
Then give me a break.
Please, Gene, I need your help. I don't have time to run around.
Her voice finally softened.
What happened out there? You sound really upset.
I am upset. Everything blew up. I was right in the middle of interviewing her when LAPD burst in like a damn clown car at the circus. It was ridiculous, Gene, and unnecessary. Fielding knows something and he won't say what.
I'll save you a step, Gene said. She's the one. She did those murders, Alex.
How do you know? How does LAPD know? What is going on?
You remember the hair that was found at the movie theater when Patrice Bennett was killed? Well, they pulled one off Mary Wagner's sweater from her locker at the hotel. The results just came through. It's the same hair. Fielding ran with it.
My mind raced, placing this new bit of information alongside everything else.
I see you're doing a good job staying off the case, I finally said.
Can't help what I overhear.
So did you overhear where they took her?
Gene hesitated, but only for a couple of seconds. Try the Van Nuys station on Sylmar Avenue. You better hurry. She won't be there long.
I'm on my way.
Chapter 94. I got right over to the Van Nuys station, but I was stonewalled. I was told to my face that Mary Wagner wasn't being held there. There was nothing I could do to budge LAPD. They had this woman, their suspect, and they weren't sharing her. Even Ron Burns couldn't, or wouldn't, help me out. I wasn't able to see Mary until the next morning. By that time, LAPD had transferred her to a temporary holding facility downtown, where they kept her completely tied up in interrogation, without any real progress, as I had predicted. One sympathetic detective described her to me as somewhere between despondent and catatonic, but I still needed to see Mary Wagner for myself. When I arrived at the downtown facility, the assembled press corps mob was twice the size of anything we'd seen so far, easily. For weeks, the Hollywood stalker case had made national headlines, not just local ones. Mary Wagner's mugshot was everywhere now, a blank-eyed, disheveled woman looking very much the part of a killer. The last thing I heard before I switched off my car radio was ridiculous morning talk show banter and psychobabble about why she had committed murders against rich and famous women in Hollywood. "How about Kathy Bates? She could play Mary. She's a great actress," one concerned caller asked the talk show host, who was all too glad to play along. "Too old. Besides, she already did Misery. I say you get Nikki Kidman. Get her to slap on another fake nose, wig, 30 pounds, and you're good to go," replied the DJ. "Or maybe Meryl Streep. Emma Thompson? Kate Winslet would be strong." My check-in at the station house took almost 45 minutes. I had to speak with four different personnel and show my ID half a dozen times just to reach the small interrogation room where they were going to bring Mary Wagner to me. Eventually, in their own sweet time. When I finally saw her, my first reaction, surprisingly, was pity. Mary looked as though she hadn't slept, with bruise-colored half-moons under her eyes and a drooping, shuffling walk. The pink hotel uniform was gone. She now wore shapeless gray sweatpants and an old UCLA sweatshirt flecked with pale yellow paint, the same color as her kitchen. Vague recognition flickered in her eyes when she saw me. I was reminded of some of the Alzheimer patients I regularly visited at St. Anthony's in D.C. I told the guard to remove her cuffs and wait outside. "I'll be okay with her. We're friends."
"Friends,"
Mary repeated as she stared deeply into my eyes. Chapter 95. "Mary, do you remember me from yesterday?" I asked, as soon as the guard was back out in the hallway. I had pulled up a chair and sat across from her. The plain 4x8 table between us was bolted to the floor. It was chilly in the small room, with a draft from somewhere.
"You're Mr. Cross,"
she said dully.
"FBI agent Cross. Excuse me, I'm sorry."
"Good memory. Do you know why you're here?" She tensed, though it was barely discernible from her otherwise flat affect.
"They think I'm that woman. They're accusing me of murder."
Her gaze fell to the floor.
"Murders. More than one. All those Hollywood people. They think I did it."
I was actually glad she said they. It meant I could still be a potential ally in her mind. Maybe she'd tell me some of her secrets after all. And maybe not. "We don't have to talk about that if you don't want to," I said. She blinked once and seemed to focus a little. She squinted her eyes at me, then looked down at the floor. "Would you like anything? Are you thirsty?" I asked. I wanted her to feel as comfortable as possible with me, but I was also feeling an urge to help this woman. She looked and sounded so terrible, possibly impaired. Now she looked up, her eyes searching mine.
"Could I have a cup of coffee? Would it be too much trouble?"
The coffee arrived, and Mary held the paper cup with her fingertips and sipped at it with an unexpected kind of delicacy. The coffee seemed to revive her a little, too. She kept sneaking glances at me, and she absently smoothed her hair against her head.
"Thanks."
Her eyes were a little brighter, and I saw a shade of the friendly woman from the day before. "Mary, do you have any questions about what's going on? I'm sure you must." Immediately, a pall came over her. Her emotions were palpably fragile. Suddenly, tears welled up in her eyes, and she nodded without speaking. "What is it, Mary?" She looked up to the corner of the ceiling where a camera was watching us. I knew that at least a half dozen law enforcement personnel and psychiatric specialists were tucked away less than 10 feet from where we sat. Mary seemed to guess as much.
When she did speak, it was in a whisper.
They won't tell me anything about my children.
Her face contorted as she fought back more tears.
Chapter 96. Your children? I asked, somewhat confused but going along with what she'd said.
Do you know where they are?
Her voice was wavery, but her energy had increased quite a bit already.
No, I don't, I answered truthfully. I can look into it. I'll need some more information from you.
Go ahead. I'll tell you what you need to know. They're too young to be on their own.
How many children do you have? I asked her.
She seemed dumbfounded by the question.
Three. Don't you already know?
I took out my pad. How old are they, Mary?
Brendan's 8, Ashley's 5, and Adam's 11 months.
She spoke haltingly while I wrote it all down. 11 months? It was certainly possible she had given birth a year ago, but somehow I doubted it very much. I checked the ages to be sure about what she'd said. 8, 5, 11 months? Mary nodded.
That's right.
And how old are you, Mary? For the first time, I saw anger show on her face. She balled her hands into hard fists, closed her eyes, and struggled to compose herself. What was this all about?
I'm 26, for God's sake. What difference does that make? Can we get back to my kids now?
26? Not even close. Wow. There it was. The first opening. I looked at my notes. Then I decided to take a little leap with her. So Brendan, Ashley, and Adam live at home with you. Is that right? She nodded again. When I got something right, it seemed to calm her down tremendously. Relief spread over her face, then seemed to continue down into her body. And were they home yesterday when I was there? She looked confused now, and the anger that had ebbed away edged back.
You know they were, Agent Cross. You were right there. Why are you doing this?
Her voice rose as she spoke. Her breath had gone shallow.
What have you people done with my children? Where are they right now? I need to see them right now.
The door opened, and I held my hand up to the guard without taking my eyes off of Mary. It was obvious her pulse had quickened as the agitation seemed to take hold. I took a calculated risk with her. Mary, I said gently, there were no children in the house yesterday. Her response was immediate and extreme. She sat bolt upright and screamed at me, her neck muscles straining.
Tell me what you've done with my children. Answer me this instant. Where are my kids? Where are my kids?
Steps sounded on the floor behind me, and I stood up so I could be the first one to reach her. She was raving now, screaming over and over.
Tell me! Why won't you tell me?
Now she had started to sob, and I felt sorry for her. I slowly walked around the table. Mary! I shouted her name, but she was completely unresponsive to the sound of my voice, even to my movement toward her.
Tell me where my kids are! Tell me! Tell me! Tell me this instant!
Mary! I leaned over and took her by the shoulders as gently as I could under the circumstances.
Tell me!
Mary! Look at me! Please! That's when she went for my gun.
Chapter 97.
She must have seen the holster tucked inside my jacket. In a split second, she reached up and her hand was on the butt of my Glock.
No! I yelled. Mary!
I instinctively knocked her back into her chair, but the gun wrenched free from the holster and she had it. I caught a flash of her eyes, which were glazed and crazy. I dove at her,
grabbing her wrist with one hand and the gun with the other. I continued to yell her name. Next, the two of us fell over the chair as it went down with a loud crack. I was vaguely aware of people scrambling all around us. My focus stayed on her. She strained, red-faced, slamming my side with her free fist. I now had a knee on her chest and one hand still on her wrist, pinning the gun to the ground, but she was as strong as she looked. And her finger was already wrapped around the Glock's trigger. She squirmed hard, turning the barrel of the gun toward herself and tilting her head to meet it. She knew exactly what she was doing. No! Mary! With a rush of adrenaline, fighting an equal surge or resistance from her, I managed to lift her gun hand toward the ceiling. Then I smashed it back down very hard against the floor. The Glock fired once into the wall of the interrogation room, even as it fell out of her grasp. I snatched it up, the shot still ringing in my ears, the side of my face numb. There was a brief, suspended moment of near silence. Mary stopped struggling immediately, and then, in an unbelievable echo of the previous day's events, the police descended on her like a small army. They picked her up as she flailed once again, arms and legs whipping crazily. I could hear her unchecked sobs as they carried her away.
My babies! My babies! My poor babies! Where are my children? Oh, where? Oh, where? What have you done with my children?
Her voice receded down the hall until a heavy door slammed with great finality, and she was gone. Not surprisingly, I didn't get the chance for another interview. To make matters worse, if that was possible, I saw James Truscott as I left the building about an hour later. He was among the throng of reporters gathered outside waiting for any tidbit of news. He yelled at me, "How did you get your gun, Dr. Cross? How'd that happen?" Somehow, Truscott had already gotten the story. Chapter 98. I could only wonder about the causes and the full extent of Mary Wagner's mental illness and the obvious torment and stress it was putting on her. There certainly hadn't been any time for a meaningful psych evaluation, and my part in the investigation was coming to an end now, whether I liked it or not. And to be honest, I had mixed feelings. By early that afternoon, Mary's state of mind was a moot point. LAPD's search of her house had turned up a holy trinity of evidence. A Walther PPK discovered under a blanket in her attic crawl space had already shown a preliminary ballistic match to the weapon used in murders. CSI had also found half a dozen sheets of children's stickers, and most significant, stolen family photographs from Marty Lowenstein Bell's office and Susie Cartulis's purse. Both Michael Bell and Giovanni Cartulis had positively identified the photos as having belonged to their murdered wives. "And best of all, most important anyway," Fred Van Allsburg told the small group of agents assembled in his office, 12 o'clock came and went today without incident. No new victim, no new email. It's over. I think I can safely say that." The mood was grimly congratulatory. Just about everyone was glad to leave this one behind, but the details of the case would haunt most of the team for some time, just as the D.C. sniper case still lingered in the J. Edgar Hoover building back east. It's an unsatisfying and unpleasant feeling, but also part of what drives us to do better. "Alex, we owe you one on this," Van Allsburg finally came over to me. "Your work on the case was invaluable. I have to say that. I see why Ron Burns likes you close to home." A few uneasy laughs went through the room. Agent Page reached from behind and patted my shoulder. He would go far in the Bureau if he could keep his passion for solving crimes. "I'd still like to take a peek at that final evidence LAPD found, and maybe get a real interview with Mary Wagner," I said.
diverting back to what I thought was most important.
Van Allsburg shook his head. Not necessary. There's no reason for me not to stick around another day, I started to say.
Don't worry about it. Paige and Fujishiro are good for the details. I can back them up. And if we really need you again, there's always frequent flyer miles, right?
His tone was artificially bright.
Fred, Mary Wagner wouldn't talk to anyone before I came. She trusts me.
At least she did, he said. Probably not anymore.
It was a blunt statement, but not aggressive.
I'm still the only person she's opened up to. I hear LAPD is getting nowhere with her.
Like I said, you're just a plane ride away if we need you back.
I spoke about it with Director Burns and he agrees. Go home to your family. You have kids, right?
Yes, I have kids.
Hours later, packing my bag at the hotel, I was struck hard with another kind of realization. Actually, I couldn't wait to get home. It was a huge relief that I'd be back in D.C. again, with no immediate travel plans. But, and the but was important. Why had that fact been so far from my mind in Van Allsburg's office? What were these blinders I wore, and how did I keep forgetting I had them on? What kind of dramatic wake-up call did I need before I got the message? On the way to the airport, I figured out another piece. It just hit me. The A's and B's on the children's stickers at the crime scenes. I knew what the letters meant. Mary's imaginary children's names. Ashley, Adam, Brendan. Two A's and a B. I phoned it in on my way out of L.A.
Part 5. End of story. Chapter 99.
The storyteller was done killing. Fini. It was over. And no one would ever know the whole truth about what had happened. End of story. So he threw himself a party with some of his best buddies from Beverly Hills. He told them he'd just gotten a gig writing a screenplay for an A-list director, a big dopey thriller based on a dopey bestseller. He'd been given license to change anything he didn't like, but that was all he could say about it right now. The director was paranoid, so what's new? But a big party was definitely in order. His friends thought they understood what was going down, which gave him some idea how little they knew him. His best friends in the world, and hell, none of them knew him at all. None of them suspected he could be a killer. How frickin' unbelievably crazy was that? No one knew him. The party was at the Snake Pit Ale House, a bar on Melrose where they'd held a fantasy football league during his early days in L.A., soon after he'd arrived from Brown University to act and maybe dabble at writing scripts. Serious, worthy stuff, not box office crap. The order of the night is free beer, he said as each of his buds arrived at the bar, and wine for the wussies among you. So, I guess it's vino all around? Nobody drank wine, not one of the 14 pals who came to the bash. They were all glad to see him out and about, and also about his new gig, though some of the more honest ones admitted they were jealous. Everybody started calling him A-list. He and David and John Boy and Frankie were still at the bar when it closed at a little past 2. They were overanalyzing a movie called We Don't Live Here Anymore. They finally more or less stumbled outside and exchanged Hollywood hugs on the street next to Johnny's fucking Bentley. Talk about A-list. The spoils of the last movie he'd produced. A $400 million grosser worldwide, which made all the rest of them sick. Because all he'd done was buy a dipshit graphic novel for $50,000, then sign up The Rock for $10 million. Genius, right? Yep, 'cause it worked. Love you, man. You're the best, you sick, obnoxious, ostentatious bastard. You too, Davy, he yelled as the silver Bentley pulled away from the curb and sped west. I know, I'm just a bastard right now, David yelled back.
But I have dreams of being sick, obnoxious, and ostentatious, too, and talented, which is what's holding me back in this town. Hey, man, I hear you. I feel you, he yelled. CAA list, you hack. I'm just a storyteller, he yelled back.
Then he was kind of floating down a side street to his own car, a 7-year-old Beamer, not a Suburban. He was definitely 3 sheets to the wind, happy as a pig out of a blanket, humming Jimi Hendrix's The Wind Cries Mary, an in-joke that only he would get. Until suddenly he began to sob, and he couldn't make himself stop. Not even when he was sitting on the lawn of some grungy apartment building with his head down between his legs, bawling like a baby. And he was thinking, just one more, just one. One more kill and I'll be good.
Chapter 100.
The next morning he couldn't sleep, and he drove up and down Melrose, past L'Angelo, which used to be Emilio's, the Groundling Theater, where Phil Hartman got his start, Tommy Tang's, the original Johnny Rockets, the Blue Whale, his city, man, his and Proud Mary's. It was around 5:30 or so when he bounced into the Starbucks on Melrose, which used to be the Burger That Ate L.A. back in the day. Man, he did not like Starbucks. But they were open, the greedy little yuppie bastards. The numbers dictated that they be open, right? The numbers ran everything these days. And here he was, proving the number crunchers right. 5:30 in the a.m., and he was already making their day. God, he despised these dipshit coffee places. The new McDonald's, overpriced ripoffs. He remembered when a cup of coffee was 50 cents, which seemed about right. But Sumatra Blend, now that was worth $2.50 if it was worth a nickel, for a tall, which really meant a small. And the goateed schmo minding the store was too busy setting up shop to give any attention to his paying customer, his early bird, the day's first sucker. He let it go for a minute or so, but the jerk was starting to piss him off royally. Be right back, he finally told the super busy barista behind the counter, and the guy still hardly noticed him. What an ass and a half. No doubt an actor out of work. Too good for the job, right? With an attitude, which was supposed to be a good thing these days. A minute later, he re-entered the Starbucks with a piece in his jacket pocket. He was starting to rev up now. This was probably stupid. Definitely not too smart, but God, it felt pretty good. Hey, pal, my gun is getting thirsty. Right then and there, the decision was made. This arrogant fuck wannabe actor was going down for the count. He was tomorrow's headlines today. Hey, buddy, I'm waiting here for some coffee. You got any coffee at Starbucks? The barista didn't look up from his busy work even then, just waved a free hand.
Be with you.
The storyteller, the storyteller, heard the door open behind him. Another sucker arrives.
Hey, morning, Christopher.
A woman's chirpy voice came from behind. He didn't even turn to look at her. Screw her, too.
Hi, Sarah,
called the counter guy. He was suddenly all chirpy, too. Now the jackass came to the front. Now he wakes up. For Sarah. That's when he shot the dude in the chest. Right in the Starbucks apron.
Forget the coffee, Christopher. Don't need it now. I'm already wired.
Then he turned to see about the woman. First time he ever looked at her. Chirpy-looking blonde, maybe mid-30s, wearing a black leather jacket over black pedal pushers, black thongs, too.
Hey, morning, Sarah,
he said, casual-like and friendly as a cocker spaniel off its leash in the park.
Wearing black for the funeral?
Excuse me? And he shot her too. Twice. Then one more for the barista. Just one more kill, right? He was thinking. Well, maybe two more. He robbed the cash register, took Sarah's ratty buckskin pocketbook, and off he went into the early morning L.A. smog. Heading west, across Stanley, Spalding, Genesee. Mary Smith rides again, right?
Chapter 101. I looked at Janny in the rearview mirror. The spy museum, huh? I asked. She nodded.
Absolutely.
Janny had drawn Saturday afternoon in our little lottery. Tonight was mine, Sunday day was Nana's, and Sunday night was Damon's time to howl. The Cross family weekend was all mapped out, and it was already underway. We spent the afternoon learning about ninja, cloak and dagger, and shadow spies, a construct I must have missed in my classes at Quantico. The kids tested their powers of observation in the school for spies, and even I was impressed with some of the future world props and models they had in the 21st century section. Since dinner was my choice, I decided to introduce everyone to Ethiopian food. Janny and Damon did fairly well with some of the more exotic tastes, except for the kitfo, essentially steak tartare. Still, they liked eating with their fingers, which Nana called real down-home cooking. When Janny and Nana went off to the ladies' room, Damon turned to me.
You know, you could have invited Dr. Coles.
If you wanted, he said, then shrugged. I was touched by the man-to-manness of Damon's remark. I'd even say it was adorable, except that he'd hate if I saw it that way. Thanks, Day, I said, playing it straight. Kayla and I are having dinner on Tuesday. I appreciate the thought.
She's a good lady. Everybody thinks so. You need somebody, you know.
Yeah, I know.
And she's the only person I've ever seen who can make Nana do stuff she doesn't want to.
I laughed, liking that he had noticed so much about Kayla, and his observations were mostly sharp and true.
What's so funny?
Nana asked, suddenly at the table again.
What did I miss?
What is it?
Janny asked, demanded actually.
I want to know what's going on. Was it about the spy museum? You two mocking me? I will not be mocked.
Guy's privilege, Damon said.
I bet it was about Dr. Coles.
Janny's voice turned to a squeak as her instincts landed her in exactly the right place.
We like her, Daddy, she said,
when I had neither confirmed nor denied her guess. Yeah, but you like everyone.
Guess where I got that from?
We need to have her over for dinner, Nana piped up.
Just not Tuesday, Damon told her.
Janny grinned and her eyes got wide.
Yeah, Tuesday night is date night, right, Daddy? Am I right?
Chapter 102. Tuesday night was a date night with Kayla Coles. And then so was Thursday. At a little past 1 o'clock in the morning, I was sitting with Kayla on her front porch. We'd been out there talking for at least a couple of hours. Kayla had just recruited me to do some work for the Children's Defense Fund in D.C. She used statistics to make her points, just like Nana did. 40 million uninsured in America, a new baby born uninsured every minute of every day. Sure I would help, whatever I could do, even if the circumstances hadn't been what they were.
What are you doing Saturday? She asked.
Just the question in her sweet voice made me smile. This isn't about the Children's Defense Fund, by the way. I was hoping you'd come over for one of Nana's home-cooked meals, I said.
Don't you need to ask Nana?
I laughed. It was her idea, or one of the kids. But Nana's definitely part of the conspiracy. She might even be the ringleader of the gang. If the universe wanted me to stop dating, its message was getting garbled. All day Saturday, I was a little nervous about Kayla coming over, though. This meant something, didn't it? Bringing her home. Under these circumstances.
You look good, Daddy,
Janny said from the door to my room.
I had just rejected a shirt onto the bed and pulled on a black V-neck sweater, which I had to admit looked pretty good. It was a little embarrassing to be caught in the act of preening, though. Janie invited herself in, flopped down, and watched while I finished up.
"What's going on?"
Damon wandered in next and sat beside Janie on the bed. "Anybody ever hear of privacy around here?"
"He's getting all handsome for Dr. Kayla, all dutied up and such. I like him in black."
My back was to them now, and they spoke as if I weren't there, their voices just a little stagey.
"Think he's nervous?"
"Mm-hmm, probably.
You think he'll spill something on himself during dinner?"
"Definitely."
I turned on them with a roar and grabbed them both before they could separate and squirm away. They exploded into screams of laughter, forgetting for an instant that they had outgrown this kind of horseplay. I rolled them both around on the bed, going for all the ticklish spots I knew from past tickle fests.
"You're going to get all wrinkly,"
Janie yelled at me.
"Daddy, stop."
"That's okay," I said. "I'll have to change anyway.
When I spill something on myself."
I chased them all the way down to the kitchen. Then we pitched in to help Nana with the parts that she would let us. Adding a leaf to the dining table, putting out the good china and new candlesticks. Nana was showing off a little, maybe a lot. Fine by me. I've got no problem eating her finest. Never have. After dinner, which was pretty amazing, two herb-roasted chickens with oven fries, asparagus, mescaline salad, and coconut cake, Kayla and I got out of there. We took the Porsche, and I drove out to the tidal basin and then up to the Lincoln Memorial. We parked, then strolled the length of the reflecting pool. It's a beautiful, tranquil spot at night. For some reason, not too many tourists make it there after sunset.
"Everything was perfect," she said as we approached the Washington Monument. "Back at your house."
I laughed. A little too perfect for my taste. "Didn't you think they were trying too hard?" It was Kayla's turn to laugh.
"What can I say? They like me."
3 dates in a week. Had to give them ideas.
Kayla smiled. "Gave me some ideas. Wanna hear?"
"Like what? Give me an example, a for instance."
"My house isn't far."
"You're a doctor. Must know a lot about human anatomy."
"And you're a psychologist, so you know the human psyche, right?"
"Sounds like a lot of fun." And it was. But then the job got in the way again. Chapter 103. "I'll be out there tomorrow. That's the best I can do. I'll book a flight to L.A. right now."
I couldn't believe the words were coming out of my mouth, even as they did.
I had been on the phone with Fred Van Allsburg for less than a couple of minutes, and my response was pretty much automatic, almost as if I'd been programmed to answer in a certain way. What was this, the Manchurian Candidate? What part was I playing? Good guy? Bad guy? Somewhere in between? I was definitely eager to meet with Mary Wagner again, drawn by curiosity almost as much as by obligation. The LAPD hadn't been able to get her to talk to them, apparently not for days, so they wanted me to come back to California to consult. And I needed to do it. Something still bothered me about the murder case, even if Mary was as guilty as she appeared to be. Of course, I wanted the trip to be as short as possible. In fact, I left everything packed except my toothbrush when I got to the hotel in L.A. It probably helped me feel as though the trip was more temporary. Anyway, my interview with Mary Wagner was scheduled for 10 o'clock the following morning. I thought about calling Jamila, but decided against it. And right then I knew that it was completely over between us. A sad thought, but a true one. And I was sure that we both knew it. Whose fault was it? I didn't know. Was it useful or important to try to place blame?
Probably not, thought Dr. Cross. I spent the night going over the past week's reports and transcripts, which Van Allsburg had messengered over to me. According to everything I read, the three children, Brendan, Ashley, and Adam, seemed to be the only thing on Mary's mind. It made my direction pretty clear. If the children were all that Mary could think about, that's where we'd begin tomorrow morning. Chapter 104. At 8:45 in the morning, I found myself in a different but identical-looking room to the one where I had last interviewed Mary Wagner. The guard escorted her in exactly on time, almost to the second. I could see right away that several days of interrogation had taken a toll. She wouldn't look at me, and sat stoically while the officer cuffed her to the table. He then took a position inside the room next to the door. Not my first choice, but I didn't argue it. Maybe if there was a second interview, I'd try to loosen things up. Good morning, Mary.
Hello.
Her voice was neutral, a minimal show of following the rules. Still no eye contact, though. I wondered if she had served time before, and if she had, for what? Let me tell you why I'm here, I said. Mary, are you listening to me? No response from her. She clenched and unclenched her teeth, staring at a single point on the wall. I sensed that she was listening, but trying not to show it. You already know that there's a significant amount of evidence against you, and I think you also know that there are still some doubts about your children. She finally looked up, and her eyes burned into my skull.
Then there's nothing to talk about.
Actually, there is. I pulled out my pen and laid a blank piece of paper on the table. I thought you might like to write a letter to Brendan, Ashley, and Adam. Chapter 105. Mary changed in a beat, just the way I'd seen her do before. She looked up at me again, her eyes and mouth noticeably softer. A familiar vulnerability showed across her features. When she was like this, it was hard not to feel something for Mary Wagner, no matter what she had done. I'm not allowed to remove your handcuffs, I said, but you can tell me what you'd like to say. I'll write it for you, word for word.
Is this a trick?
She asked, and she was practically pleading for it not to be.
This is some kind of trick, isn't it?
I had to choose my words carefully. No trick. It's just a chance for you to say whatever you want to say to your kids.
Are the police going to read it? Will you tell me? I want to know if they are.
Her responses fascinated me, a mix of high emotion and control. All of your conversations in here are recorded, I reminded her. You don't have to do this if you don't want to. It's up to you. Your choice, Mary.
You came to my house.
Yes, I did.
I liked you.
Mary, I like you too.
Are you on my side?
Yes, I am on your side.
The side of justice, right?
I hope so, Mary. She looked around the room, either weighing her options or searching for the right words. I didn't know which. Then she turned back. Her eyes locked onto the piece of paper between us.
Dear Brendan,
she said in a whisper. Just Brendan?
Yes. Please read this to your brother and sister, because you're the big boy in the family.
I took it down verbatim, writing fast to keep up with her.
Mommy has to be away from you for a while, but it won't be long. I promise. Promise. Wherever you are now, I know they are taking good care of you. And if you get lonely or want to cry, that's okay too. Crying can help let the sadness out. Everyone does it sometimes, even Mommy. but only because I miss you so much.
Mary paused, and a pleased look came over her, as if she had just seen something sweet. Her eyes were fixed on the far wall, and she had an almost heartbreaking smile on her face. She continued,
"When we're all together again, we'll go for a picnic, your favorite. We'll get whatever we want to eat and drive out somewhere pretty and spend the whole day. Maybe we'll go swimming, too. Whatever you want, sweetie pie. I'm already looking forward to it. And guess what? You have a guardian angel watching over you all the time. That's me. I give you goodnight kisses in your dreams when you go to sleep at night. You don't have to be afraid because I'm right there with you. And you're right here with me."
Mary stopped, shut her eyes, and sighed loudly.
"I love you very, very much. Love, Mommy."
By now, she was leaning much closer to the table than when we'd begun. She held on to the letter with her eyes, still speaking to me in a soft voice, a whisper.
"Put 3 X's and 3 O's at the bottom. A kiss and a hug for each of my babies."
Chapter 106. The more I heard, the more I doubted that Mary Wagner could have invented these 3 children entirely. And I had a bad feeling about what might have happened to them. I spent the afternoon trying to track the children down. The Uniform Crime Report came back with a long list of child victims matched to female killers in recent decades. I've heard and read somewhere that shoplifting and the killing of one's own children are the only 2 crimes that American women commit in equal numbers to men. If that was true, then this thick, voluminous report only represented half of the child murders on record. I gritted my teeth, literally and figuratively, and did another run through the disturbing database. This time I searched for multiple homicides only. With that list compiled, I started wading through. A few of the more famous names jumped out right away. Susan Smith, who had drowned both her sons in 1994. Andrea Yates, who killed all 5 of her children after several years of struggling with psychosis and profound postpartum depression. The list went on and on. None of these female perpetrators could be considered the victims in their cases, but the dominance of severe mental health issues was clear. Smith and Yates were both diagnosed with personality and clinical disorders,